KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. U.S. Attorney General Alberto Gonzalez announced his resignation today, effective September 17th. In the hour ahead, we'll get reaction and analysis to the resignation. We'll also hear from you, our listeners. That's all coming up after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to this morning's forum. Alberto B. Gonzalez resigned his position today as Attorney General of the United States, effective September 17th. The Attorney General's tenure has been overshadowed by clashes with Congress over the firing of nine U.S. attorneys, as well as over the use of unwarranted wiretaps, National Security Agency surveillance programs. The first Hispanic to hold the cabinet-level job of the nation's chief law enforcement officer, Gonzalez has been hit with accusations of perjury and blamed for being the legal mastermind behind the use of torture and terror interrogations. His resignation comes on the heels of the resignation of Bush administration political advisor Karl Rove. And in this forum hour, we focus our attention on the resignation of Alberto Gonzalez. We're going to be joined by a panel. We want to go first to Washington, though, and welcome Bennett Roth aboard here. He's Washington correspondent for the Houston Chronicle and has been following Attorney General Gonzalez's career, well, way back in the, to the Texas days. And welcome, Bennett Roth. Good to have you with us.
Good to be here.
Yes, the first question is, since I mentioned the Texas days, this is, with the possible exception of Karen Hughes, the last of the Texans with Karl Rove's resignation. And one has to wonder what kind of effect this is going to have on President Bush. I remember when Ed Meese left the attorney generalship, Ronald Reagan was really quite unhappy because he felt as if, for lack of a better word, his cronies were all gone.
That's true. I mean, President Bush brought a loyal group of Texans who had worked with him in the governor's office and some before that to the White House, and he relied on them, and he values loyalty almost above all else. And that was one of the reasons I think he put Gonzalez in the attorney general's office in the second term. And it's going to be it's a tough loss, and you can even tell it in Bush's today in his announcement. There's a certain amount of anger, maybe a little bitterness, that he's losing this group of people that he's come to rely on.
Why do you suppose Attorney General Gonzalez has resigned? Back in March, he said he would not resign, and in June, he said, I'm going to sprint to the finish and protect our kids, and now we have this resignation.
Well, I think he has become a distraction. I think the administration really needs to clear the decks. They've got a big fight over the Iraq policy coming up, a big fight over the budget, and they just can't afford days and days of headlines and Senate and House hearings on this issue.
Well, you followed the issue, again, going back to Texas, and there's been certainly nothing that has been proven with respect to Attorney General Gonzalez and misbehavior or perjury, though a lot of accusations have been flying around. How do you assess overall just his general ethics and integrity? That's really what's on the line here.
You're right. There's been nothing proven that he's done anything wrong. He is a lawyer, first and foremost, and he represents his client, and will always tell you that this is not his point of view. This is not his stand. He is just doing the best he can for his client, that being the president. And I think that's sort of his guiding morality and ethics, is that he's going to do the best job he can in defending his client.
And that will be presumably what he will continue to say. Well, because we're going to see more congressional action on this.
Right. The chairman of the Judiciary Committee, Patrick Leahy, has indicated that they're going to continue their probe into the U.S. attorney's case, and they may try to get Gonzalez back to testify. Who knows?
At this point, there's a lot of speculation about his successor, and since you're in Washington and have been following this, I know it's maybe premature, but the names that keep surfacing seem to be Homeland Security Chief Michael Chertoff, along with Senator Danforth, and in fact, former Deputy Attorney General James Comey. What's your take on that?
I think Michael Chertoff seems to be one of the foremost. I think they're going to try to pick someone that will not face a major contentious fight. I mean, what they really have been fearing is a long, drawn-out Senate confirmation fight. And they want someone who's already, for example, Chertoff has already been through a confirmation hearing, has a proven record as a federal judge, and there will be fewer questions about him.
And yet we keep hearing that maybe there will be questions about political cronyism with respect to the work that Chertoff has done, and maybe they ought to look for someone like Senator Danforth, who seems to be maybe in integrity above the fray.
That may be the case. Anyone who's already in the administration, too, is going to face questions about, you know, how they've implemented the Bush policy and how political they've been. So they may try to go outside. On the other hand, the president is fiercely protective of his right to appoint who he wants, and that's been always a problem here. So that if he has his mind, you know, set on Chertoff, that's who he'll nominate.
We've also heard the name of Senator Orrin Hatch and
yes.
former Deputy Attorney Larry Thompson. But like I said, at this point, it's probably a bit premature. I want to thank you, Bennett Roth, for joining us. Again, Bennett Roth is Washington correspondent for the Houston Chronicle and has been certainly following the career of Alberto Gonzalez from his days as a Texas lawyer and Supreme Court justice. He resigned this morning officially. Bennett Roth, again, I thank you.
Thank you very much.
Let me tell you who is joining us for the hour. We're going to be joined by Joseph Russinello, former U.S. attorney for both Presidents Reagan and Bush Senior, and he's joining us this morning locally. Joe Russinello, good to have you with us.
Good to talk to you.
Also with us this morning is Philip Carter. He's Associate Attorney at McKenna, Long & Aldrich, also runs a blog called Intel Dump, and he joins us this morning. He's also an Iraq War veteran and joins us this morning from Los Angeles. Philip Carter, good to have you.
Good morning.
Good morning. We're also going to be joined by Vic Amar, Professor of Law now at UC Davis. Let me begin, Philip Carter, if I may, with you. Again, a lot of speculation about why now. What's your take?
I think the why now has a lot to do with rebranding the Bush administration as it heads into the 08 campaign. But to pick up on what our Houston Chronicle colleague said, I think the real essence here is this question of loyalty. And did Alberto Gonzalez take that duty so far that he began to provide bad counsel and bad stewardship of the Justice Department and perhaps even confuse his duty of loyalty to the president with his duty to the Constitution and to the United States?
And from what you're posing that sort of as a rhetorical question, certainly the Democrats seem to be convinced that that is the case.
I think so, and I think that this has been one of the main criticisms of Alberto Gonzalez since his time in Texas, that he took this duty of loyalty so far that whether it was in the context of advising then-Governor Bush on death penalties or in the context of advising President Bush on the Geneva Conventions, he confused what his client wanted with what the law demanded.
A lot of questions about loyalty and partisan politics, but also questions, again, as I alluded to in my introduction, about his role in with respect to what went on at Guantanamo and Abu Ghraib. And how does that play in your judgment?
Well, it certainly taints Alberto Gonzalez, and it also taints his team. I think this may be one of the arguments for Mike Chertoff, because as it's been reported since he left the federal government first, where he was Assistant Attorney General in charge of the Criminal Division, he was one of the voices inside the Justice Department saying, hey, wait a minute, we have a good model, we have a criminal justice model, we should use that, we shouldn't compromise our ideals. And I think this specter of Abu Ghraib and Guantanamo and the policies that Al Gonzalez advocated for is going to hang over the confirmation hearing for whoever is picked to choose to take his place.
You're suggesting that it would not only be in the best interest of the Bush administration, but probably politically wise for them to take someone who doesn't have that kind of association.
I doubt the Senate, and particularly the Senate Judiciary Committee led by Pat Leahy, will give its advice and consent to any nomination for anyone that was bound up with these policies. These were aberrational policies, and there is no way that the Senate will allow an attorney general to take this office who is president of the creation for them.
Philip Carter, again, is associate attorney at McKenna, Long & Aldrich and runs the Intel Dump blog. He's with us from Los Angeles. Joe Russinello is with us here locally, former U.S. attorney with Presidents Reagan and Bush 1. And this came as a total surprise to you, huh, Joe?
Yes, it did. I thought that from everything that had been said, although there's always doublespeak coming out of Washington, but I thought that with everything that had been said that he was going to stick it out and that the president was committed to standing by him for the duration.
Certainly seemed like he was going to tough it out. So any guesses as to why that's not the case?
Oh, I think it's from everything that everybody else has said, I think they're right on the mark here. It was a terrible distraction to the Department of Justice. It was demoralizing probably to many of the career people in the department. I don't know that it necessarily spilled out into the field, into the U.S. Attorney's offices. But they no doubt saw that all of the attention that was being focused on him, because he really had become kind of a lightning rod for disagreements with the policies of the administration, that this was interfering basically with the function, and that from his perspective, I mean, he's always been the kind of person, if you heard the litany of things that he's done in public service, sort of a selfless public servant, that he recognized this himself and decided that for the sort of greater good of the department and for the administration, it was time for him to go.
And yet,
I don't agree, by the way, and it's not a surprise, that all of these things that have been said about his association with the terrorism policies of the department and all of the rest of this stuff have somehow poisoned him or necessarily have contaminated anybody that may come along. The decision of the Supreme Court was a close decision. I think that the policies that were established with regard to the Geneva Convention and the research that was done was carefully done. I don't think that they need to hang their heads. I think by the same token, the Congress suffers incredibly bad ratings in the polls, and they probably are looking not for a fight, but rather for an opportunity for them to sort of show their leadership, perhaps, and confirm somebody who really can lead the department forward.
Democratic muscle rippling? Is that what you're saying, in part?
Well, I mean, it's not just that. And this is Washington, after all. I mean, these. I think that what got them all sort of off on a tear against him was the misstatements of McNulty when he first went up to the Congress in February with regard to the U.S. attorney issue, trying to explain that there were legitimate reasons for the termination, instead of just saying basically, as anyone should have said, look, this is an internal personnel matter within the Department of Justice, and really, quite frankly, because it is, it's you know, within the executive branch and none of the Congress's business, and that would have been the end of it. But in an attempt to give an explanation with, as we now know, imprecise and incomplete information, McNulty provided an opening for them to sort of identify that there was something more afoot here, and that led us on this course we were on. This is not unique to this administration. These things have happened in the past. They've been kept, as you might expect, within the family, and they should have in this case.
And McNulty and others simply should have said, as you're suggesting, this is an internal matter, end of it.
Yeah, yeah, that's right. I'm going to have to leave you for 2 minutes, but I'll be back.
Okay, and I appreciate that. We're going to continue talking with Joseph Russinella, former U.S. attorney. We want to talk with Vic Amar, though, who's professor of law at UC Davis and who's joining us from there. I didn't even realize that you moved from Hastings to UC Davis, Vic.
I have.
Hope it's a good move for you. And
it is.
Welcome aboard here this morning.
Thank you, Michael.
How do you see this matter? As we've said, you know, there really has been nothing proven untoward in terms of the tenure of Attorney General Gonzalez at this point. Lots of course, accusations, but and he's been on the griddle and certainly lost his memory in many occasions, but at the same time, there really isn't anything legally that he's been charged with.
Well, I guess I'd say a few things. First, I mean, there's a lot of calls for a special prosecutor to kind of investigate some of these matters more thoroughly. I guess the second thing I would say is, you know, oftentimes you're not going to have conclusive proof of some of these things because of the invocation of executive privilege. A lot of the key documents, a lot of the key kind of witnesses may not kind of see the light of day because the administration controls what Congress has access to. I mean, there's certainly been plenty of kind of inconsistencies and kind of hints of less than completely honest dealings with Congress. And although I think it's certainly true that every attorney general, especially in modern times, is going to, you know, run into difficulties because there's just so many complicated issues that arise, you know, Gonzalez wasn't attorney general for that long. He had a particularly contentious run in his 3 years. You know, there's a lot of big things, not just the U.S. attorney firings, but the, you know, NSC surveillance program. NSA surveillance program, you know, the visit to John Ashcroft with then White House Chief of Staff Andrew Carr to try to strong arm allegedly Ashcroft into signing off on the surveillance program. A lot of these things, you know, stand out in the same way that, you know, when Clinton was president, I think it's fair to say that he was plagued by more than his fair share of scandal.
Do we have here just, putting the partisan politics and the political infighting aside, question of following the Constitution as the chief law enforcement agent of the land, as opposed to, well, violating or being accused of violating, or to some extent being loose with personal ethics?
Well, I think it's a little of both. I think, you know, a lot of attorneys general that have a different take on the Constitution and a different kind of policy preference from Congress are not going to be popular on the Hill. So, for example, you know, I don't think President Reagan's Attorney General Edwin Meese was that well-liked by a lot of Democrats in Congress. But I don't remember there being as many kind of insinuations or accusations of personal dishonesty as have been leveled against Attorney General Gonzalez. Two other points to note. You know, Gonzalez came to D.C. not really that experienced in a lot of the matters that he had to oversee as Attorney General. He was a state court judge. He was a state law practitioner in Texas, and he never really had to probably think about a lot of the distinctively federal constitutional matters and the relationship between the three federal branches that he was confronted with here. The other thing, and this probably transcends the Attorney General, one of the hallmarks of the Bush administration is that President Bush seems to prefer kind of personal loyalty and personal familiarity over other traits or characteristics when he's filling out his team. And so, you know, I think a lot of people would criticize Attorney General Gonzalez for having been too personally loyal to President Bush and kind of giving Bush the legal advice Bush wanted to hear rather than what kind of a sober, objective outsider might have said, especially with regard to things like the war on terror.
And Attorney General Gonzalez, and by the way, he will be Attorney General until September 17th, has also been criticized for his political loyalty to Karl Rove. Not that we necessarily can separate that from President Bush, but that's what we're hearing.
Yeah, and again, you know, I think in Rove and Gonzalez, you have examples of Bush really leaning on people whom he can trust personally. And, you know, when someone trusts you personally, it's hard to say no to that person. So when the president wants kind of legal authorization for military tribunals or for violations of international norms that the U.S. may or may not be bound by, it's kind of easy sometimes for a lawyer to give the advice that the client wants. It happens in other settings, too. I think tax lawyers sometimes do that too, but I'm not sure that that always makes for the best kind of attorney general, looking at things historically.
In some ways, it's also been said of Harriet Myers, hasn't it?
And that's indeed one of the reasons I think she had trouble when she was appointed to the Supreme Court, is because she hadn't demonstrated kind of an independent gravitas that you'd look for in a justice and even in an attorney general. You know, the attorney general is surely part of the president's administration, part of his team, but there's also this tradition that the Department of Justice is supposed to be somewhat independent because law enforcement is kind of a special executive branch function.
Nick Amar with us this morning from UC Davis is professor of law there. I want to go back to Philip Carter, who's with us from Los Angeles and, again, runs the blog Interdump and is associate attorney at McKenna Long and Aldrich and IntelDump. Excuse me. Philip Carter, the insinuations and accusations that Professor Amar refers to, give us a little more of your sense of what we deserve to call kind of the critical view of Attorney General Gonzalez at this point.
Well, I think that it's useful to look at certain specific policies and look at the kind of advice that he gave to the Bush administration. The most famous memo that he wrote came in January 2001 when he advised the president that it was okay, essentially, to set aside the Geneva Conventions and declare that they don't apply to al-Qaeda. This was a minority view within the administration. It's an extreme minority view among legal scholars who study international law, and it would have been helpful both for his client, George Bush, and for the country as a whole for him to have that independent gravitas that Professor Amar talks about, to step back and present the arguments and say, on balance, this is the case, but here are all of the substantial counterarguments, and you should be aware of those, too. Other people in the administration did that. William Howard Taft, the legal advisor for the State Department, filed a strong dissent on behalf of Secretary Powell, but Al Gonzalez was not playing the role of honest broker. He was really playing the role of advocate, and that's a very dangerous thing for a lawyer to do, whether he is White House counsel or attorney general.
And what about the whole question of personal ethics?
Well, I think, again, this goes to how you define your duty. You know, this is somewhat of a parlor game for Washington attorneys, particularly those in the Justice Department or in the government, because everyone swears the same oath to the Constitution of the United States. But what does that mean in practice? Does that mean that you work for the president? Does that mean that you work for your agency head? Does that mean you work for some abstract principle? It becomes very difficult in certain cases to choose. Alberto Gonzalez never had difficulty making that choice, though, because for him it was always the same. His client and his client's interests were what really drove the train. And I think that's a disturbing thing for a lot of lawyers to accept, because we all sort of do swear allegiance to these higher ideals in the Constitution and would like to think that when the chips are down, we will adhere to those higher principles.
Let me go back to former U.S. Attorney General, former U.S. Attorney Joseph Russinello, who was U.S. Attorney under both the Reagan and Bush senior administrations. And Joe Russinello, this whole attorney scandal to you has been from the get-go almost much ado about nothing?
Yeah, absolutely. In the past, I think this has happened. I was a two-term U.S. Attorney in the 80s. The process then was the same as now. That is that when you completed your first term, you had to resubmit an application if you wanted to be reappointed. And it was virtually the same as what you did the first time. You had a questionnaire you had to fill out. The background check was done. It was obviously more perfunctory than the first time. But the process of being considered by, your nominator, the senator from your state, in my first appointment it was Hayakawa, and my second it was Pete Wilson. So there was no gimme. The process of the White House weighing in with the Department of Justice to find out whether or not I'd been faithful to the policies and the priorities of the department, all of that was in place, and there were a significant number of us as U.S. attorneys who were up for reappointment, and there were some who weren't reappointed. Now there was no clamor, there was no uproar. There was no public hearing. There was no consternation, anything like that, because obviously the candidates knew, as did all of these candidates, that this is an appointment that is limited. You serve at the pleasure of the president. If for any reason the president is not satisfied with what you're doing, whether because you're not working diligently enough or you're not adhering to the to the policies of the department, or you've lost the confidence of your staff or whatever, you can be not appointed. You could be terminated. And I think that the significant number of persons may well have not been reappointed, but they moved on with their lives. They obviously wanted to have a career in the private sector, and it wouldn't have benefited them to have publicized that they were found unsuitable for whatever reason. So I think as I said before, what made this different was that the department, instead of sort of keeping it within the family, decided for whatever reason that it needed to give an explanation to the Congress and did not level with the Congress, did not give the full story, because the person who carried the message didn't have the full story.
We're coming up on our break, and once again, we're talking about the resignation of Attorney General Alberto Gonzalez. You can join us toll-free. Please do. 866-733-6786. That's toll-free, 866-733-6786, or by email, forum@kqed.org. You're listening to Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. We're talking about the resignation of Attorney General Alberto Gonzalez, who resigned earlier today following a good deal of controversy, immense controversy, as well as congressional testimony and accusations back and forth and political fighting of one sort or another. We're joined this hour by Joseph Russinello, former U.S. attorney for both Presidents Reagan and Bush first, by Philip Carter, associate attorney at McKenna, Long & Aldridge, and also the man who is in charge of Intel Dump Blog. And we also talking Vic Amar, professor of law at UC Davis. We spoke earlier with Bennett Roth, who is Washington correspondent for the Houston Chronicle. And I'm going to go to your phone calls forthwith. In fact, you can join us toll-free. Our toll-free number available to you is 866-733-6786, or you can join us by emailing us with any questions or comments you might have. And the email address is forum@kqed.org. I wanted to just get you on record, Joseph Ursinello, with respect to, the whole torture question in Gonzalez, who has been kind of identified with it, as Philip Carter said earlier, and that certainly plays into a lot of the acrimony and a lot of the enmity that was visiting him. And how do you see it?
Well, I mean, I read the memos John Wu prepared that were in an attempt to identify whether or not the combatants were subject to the Geneva Convention, and I think that they were very persuasive. I debated on these issues at a time, you know, several years ago when this was sort of topical, until the Supreme Court ruled on the matter. I think that there were as many people who were kind of in academia who believed that you could make the case that they were not subject to the Geneva Convention as there were people who said, no, absolutely, they were subject to Geneva Convention. Everything turned on whether they really were a sort of identifiable or, you know, uniformed force and whether that was what the Geneva Convention really directed its attention to. In any case, I think the idea that somehow or another Gonzalez was the mastermind of the policy, he was just sort of misplaced. Certainly, as the Attorney General, he is the one who commissioned he may have been in transition from White House to Department of Justice at the time, but basically he had a responsibility either as counsel to the President in the White House or as the Attorney General to have that issue researched and to make recommendations on what to do with it once it was researched. Abu Ghraib is an aberration. I think that everybody recognizes that the abuse of those prisoners was not just a question of the application of the Geneva Convention, but, you know, fundamental morally reprehensible conduct, and it's been treated as such. And I've never heard him defend it, and I don't think anybody can really defend it. We're better than the enemy in so many ways, and if we are the same, we're, you know, destined to fail. But I mean, that's in a wartime footing, and you know, this is a Department of Justice that really is more like the Department of Justice in 1941 or 42 to 1945 than the Department of Justice, you know, since the 50s. The Cold War did not really implicate the Department of Justice in so many ways, except for the prosecution of espionage cases, which were almost like white-collar crime. They were prosecutable offenses, but there was a considerable component of foreign counterintelligence that was in play, carried out by professionals, because there was an identifiable enemy. This enemy is more vicious. It's more unpredictable, and it's ideologically fixated, and it does not bend to sort of rational discussion. And the Department of Justice has to kind of deal with the enemy as it finds it. I think that the Patriot Act, which is in most part the architecture of the department, misunderstood in many ways because it wasn't fully explained to the public, but it did get the support of the Congress because the Congress was persuaded that it was not a major step, but really something that was a modification of existing practices and designed to deal with an enemy such as we confront now. Like it or not, I think it's worthwhile, and I think it's valuable, as is much of the surveillance program that has also been hot-button issues. And I don't think they're going to change, and I don't believe that any attorney general who comes in would really be serving the public well by announcing or suggesting that there was going to be a change in those policies. They're important for the protection of the American people, which is, quite frankly, first and foremost, the responsibility of all departments of government in the executive branch to keep Americans safe. So, long answer, but I think that in many ways, you know, Gonzalez has been loyal, not just to the president and his policies, but to this commitment that the president has made to keep Americans safe. And if he's taken heat on that, well, that goes with a pay grade.
And Vic Amar, let's get you on record here, particularly with respect to the application of Geneva Conventions and Gonzalez's role in all this. I mean, we really are talking about his legacy and the Patriot Act and surveillance, he's been pretty much with a broad brush hit very strongly on those.
Well, I guess I don't see things quite the same way Mr. Russinella does. I mean, a lot of the arguments advanced by the administration, both internally and in kind of court papers, I wouldn't say that they're kind of completely frivolous or untenable, and some of the internal memos, you know, were supported by some scholars throughout the country, but I think it's quite revealing that every time the administration has taken one of these positions in front of the Supreme Court, it's been repudiated not just by the liberal justices, but by Justices Scalia and Justices Kennedy. And I just think it's history is not going to judge the positions that the administration took through this attorney general very kindly. And I guess I agree with Mr. Russinella that kind of, you know, U.S. attorney hirings are often done for political/policy reasons. If U.S. attorneys don't agree with the policies of the president, then they shouldn't be reappointed, and that people may not understand that there's kind of a political dimension to the U.S. attorney selection process. And I also agree that, you know, some of that stuff maybe is the proper subject of executive privilege and doesn't have to be kind of totally shared with Congress about what's going on. But I think that certain considerations, like, you know, whether you refuse to hire somebody or rehire them because they're not going after kind of the opposing political party, those are out of bounds, both legally and ethically, in the same way that it would be out of bounds to refuse to hire somebody because of race. So I think there's a difference between politics and policy on the one hand and pure partisanship on the other, and it was kind of insinuations or intimations or hints that there might have been that kind of excessive partisan zeal that I think made Congress so interested in pursuing that particular inquiry.
Well, cutting to the chase, though, on this, I mean, one of the critical issues was that U.S. attorneys weren't being aggressive enough with regard to voter fraud, just as an example. I think that, you could make the case, not knowing the full record here, but you can make the argument that there are some prosecutors, federal prosecutors, who look at voter fraud as something which is the sort of province of the states, because it's the states that basically set the electoral policies, even in federal elections. And I've had some experience with this in my own tenure. But by the same token, when there are organized efforts to undermine the election process, such as conspiratorial efforts to register persons who are ineligible to vote because of their because they aren't citizens, or, you know, you're registering people from the graveyard, or this kind of thing, that rises to the level of a federal responsibility. And I don't know whether the U.S. attorneys who were accused here of not being diligent really were lackadaisical or were somewhat indifferent or were exercising the discretion too broadly or what. But I think that in fairness, because this hasn't been fully explained, those would be the kinds of things that it would be perfectly justifiable for the White House, in consultation with the Attorney General, and even with local officials, to take into account in determining whether or not that person should continue on as U.S. Attorney. And it is a case that predominantly voter fraud, the registration of people who are not eligible to vote, is a Democrat phenomenon, not a Republican phenomenon, because most of the people who are solicited to do that voting are probably going to be voting Democratic. And I'm speaking now from my own experiences here during my tenure.
Well, as you might imagine, Joe Russinello, I'm looking at some of the emails here, and they tend to be Democratic, too. I just want to put some of them out there before we go to our callers who are waiting patiently to join this conversation. This is Jesse, who says, many friends were worried upon hearing about Mr. Gonzalez's nomination. My response was, he was from the old Spanish school of government, a la 18th century royal politics. To his resignation today, my response is hurrah. And this is Alan from Berkeley, who says, on his best day, on his worst day, did Alberto Gonzalez's father believe that administering torture is an acceptable human activity? It's not an American value, a family value, or a human value. Neither is the imperial presidency. Here's Roland from San Francisco. He says, after all the spin, the moment of Gonzalez's resignation that spoke volumes to me was when he fled the podium. In his moment of resignation and defeat, he could not summon the courage to face the press. Here's another listener, Art in San Francisco, says, didn't Alberto Gonzalez cooperate with Bush in undermining the U.S. Constitution they both swore to uphold, with NSC spying on citizens, weakening the right of habeas corpus, signing statements that ignore or blunt the will of Congress? He was loyal to the president, but not to the Constitution. Hearings on his replacement must go into the ways in which the Gonzalez and Bush undermined the Constitution and what a new AG would do to uphold it, despite pressure from the White House. Michael writes, please, nothing illegal has been proven because this administration is stonewalling. Bush claims executive privilege to disallow testimony by key players. Rove sends official government emails through the RNC, and the RNC loses hundreds of thousands of those emails. All right, let me go to our callers here, and William, start it out. Good morning.
Yes, thank you very much. I must say that I appreciate Mr. Russinello's honesty when he speaks, and it's always good when you disagree with someone to say, well, here's our honest disagreement. In this instance, it appears to me from everything that I heard, and he's very knowledgeable. I'm surprised that he says he doesn't know that much about the situation of the attorneys having been replaced for not prosecuting the claims about Democratic fraud. You either feel that he was acting, that Gonzalez was acting for political purposes, or you feel that he wasn't. And from everything that I heard and read, it appeared to me that the attorneys that were replaced in several instances were replaced because they did not act for the political purposes of the Bush administration. Now, Mr. Russinello says, well, that's fine. It's all up to the president. Well, okay, Mr. Russinello, that's an interesting perspective. But for those of us who feel that we should always be able to regard law enforcement as being objective, it isn't okay.
Joe Russinello.
Well, I think that's a good call and a good question. This business about the sort of multi-natured U.S. attorney is something that is as old as the Republic. I mean, this goes back to the Judiciary Act of 1789, and I think that it's built into the process that at a point at which the U.S. attorney takes his oath, he no longer is the political animal that he was at the time that he was being considered for the appointment. But there are aspects of what the U.S. attorney does which will be measured by his superiors in terms of whether or not he is sort of adhering to the priorities of the department. Obviously, there are hundreds and hundreds of federal statutes. You can't prosecute every single one of the offenses in every single one of those statutes. And so there are priorities, and the priorities are generally set by the White House, which has the electoral mandate passed on to the Department of Justice, which are then articulated in sort of written memoranda and so on. And for a department to say, for example, we are going to focus on voter fraud. We're going to focus on marijuana. We're going to focus on immigration issues. Those are political decisions. And when a U.S. attorney, in his capacity as the prosecutor, basically says, you know, that's fine, but, you know, as in the case of the U.S. attorney in San Diego, I don't really want to spend a lot of time doing immigration cases, even though I'm a border district and I only have two counties in my whole district. I'd rather spend time doing white collar because that's what I think is important. Those are breaches. Those are violations, as it were, of the commitment that you would adhere to the priorities of the department. And so, are they political? Are they something else? It's a mixed question. I think it's just fair to recognize, and it's important for people to recognize.
Well, our producer, Dan Zolsa, sounds like a lawyer. Let me get Philip Carter, the other lawyer we have with us here, to opine on this. Philip Carter?
Yeah, well, first on voting rights, there's two halves to this coin. Republicans tend to focus on voting integrity, that is the detection and prosecution of fraud. Democrats tend to focus on access. And so here we have an inordinate focus in the Bush administration on issues of voting rights integrity, while the Justice Department Civil Rights Division has all been asleep at the switch for issues relating to access. And so I think that casting this as sort of all fair play is a bit askew. The second point is that you know, these U.S. attorneys do serve at the pleasure of the president, as do all senior officers in the administration. But the Justice Department has long had this tradition of, you know, sort of being above the fray, and U.S. attorneys should also be above the fray. And you know, for a couple of these U.S. attorneys, there may have been issues where they weren't towing the party line, whether it was with respect to immigration prosecutions or others. But, you know, for some of them, like David Iglesias in New Mexico, it was much more clear that this was simply an issue of partisanship and of loyalty and of being part of the Bush administration lock, stock, and barrel. And that is not the U.S. attorney tradition, nor is it the broader tradition of promoting good governance.
Let me get more of your calls on here, Chuck. You're on. Good morning.
Morning. Thanks much. I think Mr. Rusinello's statement that Abu Ghraib was an aberration, it flies in the face of the facts that the very tortured arguments that the Attorney General, the Justice Department, came up for trying to justify abusive interrogation in Guantanamo, I think clearly tried to establish the principle that that sort of interrogation is okay, and therefore the fact that you see it turning up in Abu Ghraib was not an aberration. It was a consequence of a strategy concocted by the Bush administration that the Justice Department tried to justify. Tried to come up with legal arguments in favor of. So it wasn't an aberration. It was a continuation, I think, of a conscious policy.
Philip Carter, let's get you on the record here on this. Philip Carter?
Hello. I think that Abu Ghraib and Guantanamo were the predictable results of policies that were developed in the White House, the Pentagon, and the Justice Department. And I think that to claim, as Alberto Gonzalez and others have claimed, that these were merely the acts of a few bad apples, or that these were merely the result of excesses in the heat of combat, misconstrued the situation entirely. I also take strong exception to Mr. Rusinella's comment that this is war and this is what has to be done in war. I've been to war, and I know that you don't win, particularly in this kind of war, when you sink to the level of your enemies, whether those be the Nazis, the North Vietnamese, or in this case, the insurgents that we're fighting. And we have forsaken our moral leadership in the world for what amounts to very little benefit in terms of intelligence value gained from these detainees. I think that's a very
well. How do you know that? How do you know that? You don't know. You don't have the foggiest idea of what kind of intelligence value has been gained from the interrogation in Guantanamo. And I don't. I don't equate Guantanamo and the interrogation techniques that are used there with Abu Ghraib at all. I don't think that there's any detention center that has been subjected to the degree, level, and frequency of scrutiny that Guantanamo has. But I think for you to say that that the benefit of what they've been doing down there has been, you know, insignificant is just unfounded. You don't have the foggiest idea.
Well,
there's no reason why you should.
With all due respect, the list of tactics are the same, and in fact,
leashes and sicking dogs on people, I don't think there's any evidence that that was used in Guantanamo.
Use of dogs was approved by the Secretary of Defense as a tactic for both Guantanamo and Abu Ghraib. He sent Major General Jeff Miller to Abu Ghraib in September 2003 to take tactics that were successful at Guantanamo and import them to Abu Ghraib. There's clear evidence linking the two. Now, with respect to intelligence, you're right, but I don't know. But this is a point that the public can judge based on its perceived cost and benefits of these tactics.
All right, I want to move on, gentlemen. Good argument. Let me find out what more of our listeners have to say. And let's go to Berkeley. Mark, you're on. Morning.
Hi, thanks very much. A couple comments quickly. One is on the voter fraud issue. I think that the attorneys that were released because they were investigating with a fairly even hand Republican voter fraud along with Democratic voter fraud. This administration obviously wanted only the Justice Department to focus on Democratic voter fraud. So you were watching, you were seeing, and I think if you look back to the cases that were investigated and some of the key points, there was clearly an interest in politicizing that particular process. Back on a bigger point, which is when you look at the pattern, there's really a pattern of activity, a pattern of approach, a pattern of abuse by this administration using all tools at its disposal, cutting the thing to the limit and pushing hard and playing hardball, which, as some of the commentators have said, look, that's the prerogative of the president. The president can decide who they want to pick and who they want to play, et cetera, et cetera. But if you look at the pattern, there's the clear pattern is play hardball, run it to the line, run over the line at certain points in certain places. The counterpoint to that is Congress has to give these guys no free passes. Free passes are over. Profiteering is over. They have to investigate and drill in to make absolutely everything they're doing clean and honest, which Congress is not. Congress gave Bush administration a free pass for 6 years, and that was a huge mistake, which has ended up in a situation where these guys pretty much think they can do anything they want. And when you look at the profiteering that has gone on in this administration, profiteering in Bush's father's administration and his grandfather's administration during World War II, this family has a pattern of profiteering in war and riding this thing the way they are right now.
Now, Mark, I thank you for your call. Actually, I want to pick up on Mark's remarks, not so much about profiteering, but really with the question of separation of powers. Vic Amar, executive privilege has been used, presumably will continue to be used. And how much of this is playing itself out as really just Congress and the executive in battle?
Well, I think a lot of it is. But I think the caller is very insightful in saying that, you know, it took a while for Congress to internalize how aggressive this administration has been in staking out claims of executive authority. I mean, whether those claims are justified or not, whether they're right or not, I think people would have to agree that they're relatively unprecedented in modern times. And for a long time, Congress really did give the president a blank check. Mr. Russinello talked about Congress's having kind of approved the Patriot Act, and certainly it did, but a lot of the laws that Congress passed in the wake of 9/11 were rather reflexive, and the president was given a pretty blank check. But over time, I think Congress became distrustful of this administration, which is why, you know, when things like the U.S. attorney firing episode arose, while we may never know all the particular facts, that various people in Congress thought that this might be more than just policy disagreements within the Department of Justice, but rather partisan motivation. And, you know, it's not just what you do, it's why you do it that counts. So declining to prosecute or deciding to prosecute may be a justifiable decision in the end, but it might be less justifiable if the reason you did it was because of partisan gain.
And we go to more of your calls. Blake, you're on. Thanks for waiting. Welcome to Forum.
Hi, thanks a lot. My comment is this. While it has been very entertaining for the last 6 or 8 years to listen to partisan bickering and explanations and ideologues talking back and forth and arguing issue, where I think the government is really failing us is there's no accountability. You never get to the bottom of it. It always ends up in opinion and clouded in sort of a gray cloud of partisanship. So even when you get a bipartisan commission to look at something, it's summarily discounted. So really, the question is, how are Americans supposed to digest this kind of information, and how are they supposed to come to some conclusion when all we have is partisan bickering? It's just going nowhere. And I'm wondering when this will actually end, or if anybody will really raise the flag of accountability and hold it up and say, look, we've got to come to conclusions on this kind of stuff. We can't just bicker.
I'm glad you brought up accountability, and I'd like to hear what Professor Amar has to say about perhaps enhancing that and making it more viable.
Well, I may not be as pessimistic as the caller. I think, you know, American separation of powers is clumsy, it's awkward, it's time-consuming, and perhaps Democrats on the Hill are right that it took Attorney General Gonzalez too long to resign. But at the end of the day, there is accountability, and that's why we have an election coming up, I would say next year, but it's really this year. And you know, that's a time when the American people can decide who they trust and who they don't, and we'll see what happens.
And we thank the caller, and let's get you on, Sandra, with the time remaining being short. Good morning.
Hi. Can you hear me?
I can hear you
fine. Okay, great. I wanted to say that I thought the most revealing thing that Alberto Gonzalez said in his statement was about his worst day as an attorney general being better than his father's his best day as a farm worker, because it shows that he still doesn't get it. He thinks...
Actually, forgive me, but his father was a construction worker.
I thought he said farm worker, but let's say worker. He thinks that being credibly accused of committing perjury and authorizing torture or being either incompetent or unethical as an attorney general is better than being a poor but honest construction worker. I think that's pitiful and also infuriating.
Well, I thank you for the call. I took it as a different statement, though, I must confess, and probably you're going to say that, Joe Rosenblum.
Well, I'm going to say, I've always found it incredibly challenging to be a representative of an administration in the San Francisco Bay Area, because, as you can see, there's an attitude which is almost a consensus view of cynicism toward government, no matter what government does, it seems to me. We happen to operate in an environment with two political parties that was never contemplated by the founding fathers. It was always believed that the tension would be between a congressional force and an executive force, and the checks and balances were built into the Constitution in order to accommodate that. The Constitution was never designed to deal with the situation in which you have, two parties basically fighting for control of both of the political wings of the, of the three department government, and so in a way we've struggled over the last 200 plus years in trying to accommodate the reality to the document, and I think we've done a pretty good job. I'm not fearful at all of congressional oversight. That is their responsibility. But by the same token, I think that we should keep in mind here that the tension between who's in charge, the Congress or the executive, is something that, as recently as the Wilson administration in the early part of the 20th century, was a matter of considerable debate.
Joseph Rusinella, speaking of debate, we got seconds left. I want to get a final word from Philip Carter on this. Philip Carter.
I think that it's true that the president is the one who's elected, but we have to remember that these elections come every 4 years, and I think that the final word on Alberto Gonzalez will be that he was too loyal to the president and not loyal enough to the country and the Constitution for which he was appointed to serve.
And that will be the final word, alas, because we're out of time. I want to extend thanks to Philip Carter, who is with us from Los Angeles, Joseph Rusinello with us here in the Bay Area, and Vic Amar with us from Davis, professor of law at UC Davis. Bennett Roth also joined us earlier, Washington correspondent for the Houston Chronicle. Thank you for joining us. We appreciate your listenership. Our producers are Robin Giannatasio-Mall and Kevin Guillory. Senior editor is Dan Zoll. Executive producer is Raul Ramirez. I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Claude and Louise Rosenberg Jr. Family Foundation.